Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Robert Priest, the author of The Gospel According to Renan, Reading, Writing, and Religion in 19th Century France. And the book was published by Oxford University Press in 2015. Hi there, Rob.
Hi, Roxane. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
Could you get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm a lecturer in European history at Royal Holloway University of London at the moment. I don't really have some great story of burgeoning Francophilia. I don't think I even studied French at school past about 14. I had to sort of learn it all again as an adult, but I didn't have, you know, some kind of great experience I can remember. We went on holiday to France, as people in England by and large do, but it wasn't really anything to do with that. It was simply that when I was a student, I think I just came away with the strong impression that French history was significantly more interesting than British history, which I guess was the obvious comparison. And particularly in the 19th century, it was just so much more exciting, the revolutions, the culture, everything else. And I suppose on a more serious note, it seemed to have attracted so many of the best historians. All the historians that I was interested in when I was an undergraduate, Robert Darnton, Roger Chartier, Foucault, Michel de Certeau, all seemed to be students of 18th and 19th century French history in one way or another. And so that got me interested. And I guess like any story, there's an inspirational teacher as well, which was Rebecca Spang, who taught me as an undergraduate, who really communicated her passion for France. So it was really the French history more than France, which enraptured me, I guess.
So this book, Rob, is a really multifaceted history of another very important book, Ernest Renan's Vie de Jésus, or Life of Jesus, published in 1863. How did you get interested in working on this text and its complex history?
Well, I read it as an undergraduate for the first time for a big kind of 19th century survey course, and it was in the week, which I think was called something like secularization ? And I guess from the little I read of the introduction of it before we did the reading for the class, I was kind of expecting Richard Dawkins or some kind of really strident assault on religion. And what surprised me even the first time I read it was that it just seemed way more complicated than that, more poetical, romantic, complex, didn't seem to be a kind of simplistic secular life of Jesus, which is what it is, a secular life of Jesus. And so it kind of stuck in my brain as being something which I needed to come back to. And then when I came to start a PhD on it, I think it was because it seemed to in some way provide a way into answering some of those lingering questions that I had about it. Never really gone away. The first, I guess, was how was it that this book, which was so immensely controversial, had become so forgotten? Because I don't know how many of our listeners will have heard of Renan's Life of Jesus, but it's not especially well read today.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the novels of Flaubert or the paintings of Manet or the other kind of products that we associate with Second Empire Paris still very much are widely known and widely read. And the other was it posed a kind of methodological problem for me, which was the fact that Life of Jesus was so incredibly controversial and so well-selling seemed to me to provide an opportunity to write a history of an intellectual text that was also a kind of more popular history of its impact on French culture, a kind of way of writing about how an intellectual text was read, and a way of kind of thinking about the relationship between readers and a text in a way that wasn't to do with a novel, if you like. So it just seemed to be a very unique book in that it was as popular as a novel and yet very much not a novel. And therefore seem to pose a huge number of interesting questions.
Well, and I'm going to want to come back to sort of asking about all these different aspects of the text that you explore in the book. But before we do, I'm sure that most of our listeners are familiar with Renan, but I wonder if you might give us a bit of an overview. I mean, you have a whole chapter that really focuses on his sort of the biography of Renan with respect to the text, but could you just kind of situate him for us as a figure?
Yeah, sure. So he was born to a very humble family in Brittany in a little fishing town called Tréguier. And his dad was a fisherman, in fact, who committed suicide when Ernest was very young. And he was a very promising, bright young student who took the route of many bright young people from modest backgrounds in the 19th century, which was social mobility via the church. So he entered into a seminary first in Brittany, and then at the end of the 1830s went up to study to be a priest at the seminary of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, which is one of the best known French seminaries, indeed Catholic seminaries in the world. And in mid-1840s, 1844, 1845, he started in some sense to lose his Catholic faith, in part due to his intense study of religious texts, in part due to the kind of intellectual influences that he was receiving. And so in 1845, he dramatically deserted the seminary and stopped training to be a priest and entered onto a career as a secular academic, almost completely unsupported, basically dependent on a monetary lifeline from his sister, who was a governess in Poland, in Paris, and remarkably succeeded in becoming one of Europe's leading professors of Semitic linguistics, which is to say he was a specialist in Hebrew and Hebrew philology. And then he had this long and quite remarkable career. He ascended to be the director of the Collège de France, which is one of the top positions in French academia. And he published books on the history of Christianity, the history of Judaism, also political essays, most famously What is a Nation, which is still very widely read today, as well as kind of academic works of Hebrew and Semitic linguistics. So it's kind of a spectacular ascent, if you like, and a very, very long and illustrious career.
So in the first chapter of the book, Rob, you look at Renan as both a product of the 19th century context that you're exploring and an exceptional figure. And of course, this career you've just mapped out sort of underlines that idea of what was exceptional about him. Could you just say a little bit more about your analysis along these lines?
Yeah, sure. So on the one hand, he's very much a product of that sort of persistent conflict in the 19th century, or persistent tension in France in the 19th century between the kind of pull of Catholicism and of France's kind of Catholic heritage, and on the other hand, the kind of attraction of science, of criticism, and of kind of secular ways of doing politics and ideas. And in that, I mean, just to take that sense first, in that sense, he's kind of unique or at least distinctive in the sense that he seems to want to reconcile both of those influences often rather than put those in opposition. One of the reasons I think that he comes to write A Life of Jesus, for example, is that he is absolutely fixated on and passionate about the figure of Jesus, but he can't really cling to his childhood, his kind of mother religion, if you like, of Catholicism. So he's distinctive in that sense. He's distinctive as well, typical and distinctive at the same time, in that he reads very widely in the kind of great historians and philosophers of the period, people like Cousin, Victor Cousin, Michelet, Augustin Thierry. And yet he doesn't want to write, if you like, secular history. He wants to write the history of religions.
Could you give us a sense, Rob, of, well, could you give us an overview of this book, Vie de Jésus, and then maybe also place it within his Renan's broader body of work? You know, what is it? Is it history, biography, work of theology? If you could just give us a sketch of the book and then maybe position it a little bit for us in terms of Renan's oeuvre.
Sure. So the book itself begins with this sort of strident and very striking methodological introduction, which is, I think, quite a rare thing in an academic book. He basically manages to demolish in that introduction many of what you might consider to be the kind of traditional pillars of the Catholic version of the life of Jesus one by one. For example, saying that the Gospels were just historical texts like any others, produced in a specific and particular historical context. He says that Jesus was a man, not a kind of divine being who's not the Son of God, but simply a man born in a particular Jewish context in the first century. He says that he did not perform miracles, and that any kind of, he has a very long extended, dissertation on miracles in the introduction, where he outlines why he thinks that miracles are not admissible in any truthful historical account. And then the book proceeds from there basically in kind of two parts. The first is to kind of talk about Jesus's formation, the context that formed him, Renan's particular version of what first century Palestine was like, and how we could kind of speculate about his childhood and his emotional and intellectual formation. And then the second half of the book is more about Jesus's adult life, Jesus's sermons and message and encounters with the authorities leading up to his trial and crucifixion, which Renan sees as a kind of purely historical event, not one, you know, there was no kind of gigantic thunderbolt crashing down when he was up on the crucifix, and to discount many of those things, but a kind of inevitable legal procedure, if you like, that the Roman authorities took against the man who seemed to be provoking a lot of potential sedition and danger, and who also, in Renan's view, I think somewhat foolishly, if explicably, refused to kind of back down in the face of incredible pressure, and therefore inevitably ended up getting himself killed. So it's a biography of Jesus that proceeds very much along straight biographical lines. It's also written in very fluid prose. It's not an academic dissertation about the life of Jesus, and that's one of the things which distinguished it from other books in that genre in the 19th century. And how that fits into his broader body of work? Well, by that point in 1863, Renan had largely produced his main body of work had been his general outline book on the history of the Semitic languages that he published in the 1850s. So he'd kind of made his mark with an academic work on philology, and this was his first really popular foray into history on a publishable book scale, and B, popular writing that was actually intended to have an audience beyond the academy. And it was also going to be, and it did indeed become, the first volume in a bigger project, the history of the origins of Christianity that Renan then pursued across the following decades, and which he followed then with the history of Judaism. So it's within his broader body of work, it's really, if you like, his arrival on the scene in very many ways, as well as his first departure from that more narrow philological type of scholarship.
So, I mean, I have a sense, well, from reading the book, but also from what you're saying right now, of the intellectual location of the book in Renan's career. You also discuss in the first chapter of the book the ways that Renan's own experiences shaped the kind of life of Jesus that he went on to write and publish in 1863, including this idea that, you know, he stopped believing in the divine Jesus of Orthodox Catholicism somewhere in there between the late 1830s and the publication of the book. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so it's always a difficult subject to talk about how an author's experience shaped their text, of course, and it's a bit of a minefield, and there's been a lot of psychologizing that has gone on with Renan, and I've tried to tread a careful line in the book between acknowledging that without getting too much into it. I mean, we can talk, for example, about how his particular affection for Breton Catholicism and the kind of religion of his home region shapes the way that he writes about Galilean Christianity, which the Galilean people, which he wants to distinguish very much from the people of Jerusalem and Judea in the book. And he sort of they're almost kind of quasi-Bretons. They're people who have this kind of indigenous, earthy, natural religion, which is distant from the kind of dogmatic religion that you get in Jerusalem. And so it's all the kind of things that Renan likes about French Catholicism, and none of the stuff that he doesn't like, for example. You also, I think, there's an interesting gendered dimension, which, again, could be the subject of great speculation, but I think we can certainly say that there was an enormous intellectual role for women in Renan's own life. His sister Henriette wasn't just a financial supporter of his, but also a great kind of intellectual companion. And yet, nonetheless, he never really kind of acknowledged that she was anything more than an exception to her sex. So to Renan, kind of women are the repository of the true, good, honest and sincere Christianity. And so similarly in the book, Jesus is constantly surrounded by women and children. Women and children are seen as being the kind of true conduits of Christianity. And Jesus himself is painted in somewhat androgynous tones. Another thing we might think about is the politics. In the middle of the 19th century, there were various lives of Jesus which took Jesus in a particularly left-wing or socialist direction. People like Cabet, the utopian socialist, wrote about Jesus as being kind of the first of the proletarians, and that, you know, you could analyze his miracles and see that they were often directed at the disadvantaged in society. Or you had other people writing about primitive Christianity as the kind of first form of primitive communism. Renan was very much shaped by his experience of 1848, the revolution of 1848 in particular. And he came out of that with a kind of distaste for socialism, to some extent, a kind of distaste for democracy. And it kind of confirmed for him his very kind of 19th century liberal belief in the power of great individuals and the importance of liberty. And so Jesus in the book encapsulates many of Renan's political opinions that he developed during the course of his early life as well. So Jesus isn't a socialist. Instead, he's this kind of hero of the freedom of conscience, which is precisely, you might also say, what Renan himself views himself as being. So all of these different strands from Renan's early life kind of come together in the book itself, although, of course, it's always very difficult to draw direct connections between the two things. I do think it is possible, and it is worth doing in this case.
You refer, Rob, to the hybridity of Vie de Jésus as a text. So what does this mean? And, yeah, how are you thinking about the text as something that has all of these different kind of ways of intervening in terms of 19th century French history, culture, politics?
Well, yeah, I think hybridity is the word that I use, and it's the word that I would use to describe it. Let's take, for example, the other big 19th century life of Jesus that had been published, which had been published in Germany, The Life of Jesus Critically Examined by David Friedrich Strauss. This was a book which was basically a dense dissertation with thousands of footnotes that was pursued across hundreds of pages, which kind of went into great scholarly detail and examination of every single miracle from Jesus's life, which kind of blended Hegelian philosophy with kind of high critical theology. Renan's book was nothing like this. It was written in this kind of novelistic, popular historical prose. And yet it also did seek to make scholarly contributions. So Renan does have opinions on all of these different matters that people like Strauss had dealt with. He just encodes them more within the narrative. And there are certain areas where Renan was particularly staking particular claims about the life of Jesus in the history of the New Testament. For example, he was significantly more favorable to the fourth gospel than any of the kind of highly critical German Protestant theologians and French Protestant theologians at the time were. And he does openly acknowledge that in the introduction, but he also threads it through the whole narrative. If you read the book and you look carefully at the footnotes that it does have, you see that he is much more dependent on the fourth gospel than many of his peers. So that's one example of the way in which it's it's a very hybrid text. I think also, similarly, when we talk about the politics of the book, it's often difficult to disentangle what is Renan's sincere historiographical conclusion and what is maybe a coded political dig. Mm. For example, when he talks about the trial of Jesus and he has this kind of benevolent figure of Pontius Pilate, you know, is this somehow a kind of coded message to France's own emperor, Napoleon III, who Renan kind of broadly collaborated with and supported and wanted to be indulgent towards him, particularly because at the time the book was published, I should mention that Renan had been suspended from his job by the government, you know, or was this just Renan's sincere conclusion from having carried out historical research into the New Testament and the life of Jesus? You know, there's a couple examples there of the ways in which the book seems to be pointing in multiple directions at once. Mm-hmm. There's also a hybridity, I think, at a more basic level in what does he want Jesus to be? And this is where it gets very complex and difficult to figure out exactly what Renan thought Jesus was, despite the fact he's written this whole very detailed life of Jesus, because he insists at the beginning that he's not divine. Then towards the end of the book, he says something along the lines of, if ever in human history, a human has come close to touching divinity, it was Jesus. And, you know, all of these kind of apostrophes that he makes during the book and all of these kind of excessive passages where he kind of eulogizes Jesus as being this almost quasi-divine force sit very strangely with his claims that he's doing this kind of serious historical work, which is kind of confronting many of the dogmas and presuppositions of Catholicism. So there's lots of different sorts of hybridity in the book, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So I want to move on now, Rob, to asking you some questions about what happens once the book appears. But before I do, I wanted to ask you to say something about the ad. And I just really loved that moment in the book where you talk about the ad that the publisher takes out right before the book appears. I think it's about a week before the book appears. Could you just tell a sort of brief version of that story and its significance?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, Renan was an incredibly canny operator, and him and his publisher, Michel Lévy, who was one of the most successful French publishers in the 19th century, they knew exactly what they were doing, I think it's fair to say. And so the book, it came out on the 24th of June, 1863, as you've already said, and that was a Wednesday. And so the weekend before that Wednesday, there's this notice which is placed in most of the major national French newspapers, saying basically it's completely false that Renan has been told to make changes to the book. This book is going to appear exactly as the author conceived it and exactly as it was written in the Orient, which by the way isn't true. And so basically they take out this advert saying Renan has not made any changes, when of course nobody had actually said that Renan had been forced to make changes. So they deliberately stir up this sort of suspicion that the government's been leaning on Renan, telling him to change the book. It wasn't true at all. And then they say something along the lines of how it would have been a profound mistake to have prohibited the publishing of this book, as if that's ever been under discussion, which it hadn't. Nobody had ever been discussing whether it should be banned. So, I mean, it's a pure piece of disingenuous genius. And so, you know, that's just one of the mechanisms Renan uses to make sure that his book is getting the publicity that he thinks it deserves.
I really like that moment because, you know, so much of the book is about sort of addressing this question of why it was so controversial and the debate surrounding the book, and the fact that controversy is almost provoked in advance of its release is really interesting to me. Was that a common, not that specific tactic, but was that a common feature of book publication in the 19th century, that publishers would sort of stage these scandals or at least provoke them?
Familiar with one along exactly the same lines, but it was certainly very common for bits of the mass circulation newspapers in 19th century France to be not exactly what they seemed to be, kind of paid columns to be, you know, there'd been, you know, why is a particular play getting noticed in the theatre column? It's because the person organising it has throwing some money to the paper, mm-hmm. or to kind of write, I don't know, advertorials almost, if you like. You know, that was a very well-known tactic that had been pioneered right in the beginning of mass circulation newspapers in the 1830s and 40s. So by making up an advert that wasn't an advert, Michel Levy and Renan were doing something which was not especially out of the ordinary, although I think the particular character of it was quite special.
So yours is the first book, Rob, to really focus on the popular reception of the book in the 19th century. I mean, you do talk about how other scholars have maybe explored academic responses or, you know, some of the press, you know, reviews and responses, but that you're really interested in the reception of the book, especially, you know, among a wider audience, a French public in the 19th century. So what are the specific questions that you set about answering, you know, on this front, thinking about popular reception? Mm. How did you get at these questions? What sources did you draw on? And I guess what did you come up with in response?
I guess one of the lingering questions, I mean, I knew that the book had sold in these extraordinary numbers, in the hundreds of thousands, the kind of numbers that you associate with someone like Emile Zola at the end of the century. So I knew that there was a big, broad readership out there. Mm-hmm. And one of the other canny things that Renan had done was to release a cheap, popular edition of the book 1 year after the first edition of the book. It was very cheap for the time, 1.25 francs, which put it in the reach of many people, not mm-hmm. everybody, of course. And this was also a time of burgeoning literacy. We're talking about a period when somewhere in the region of, let's say, 70% of the French population can read, and it would have been significantly higher in urban areas, for example. Mm-hmm. So I knew that there was this popular audience, and I wanted to know, well, the first thing I had to examine, if you like, the kind of academic and print response. But once I'd done that, I wanted to know how much did, if you like, ordinary readers, how much did their responses map onto those in the press? And then I also had this question, which in some ways is not an answerable question and maybe not a sensible question even to ask, but there was a famous book called The Secularization of the European Mind by Owen Chadwick, which said about Renan's Life of Jesus, who knows, maybe people read it and it changed their views about Christianity, and maybe one day we'll find out whether that was the case, but something like, you know, it's almost impossible to know. And of course, that's too big and in some ways too simplistic a question to answer. You know, did reading the book change people's minds? How could we ever really get at that? But I do think we can get closer to that than previous historians have imagined. And the main way that I went about this, apart from reading hundreds and hundreds of many incredibly tedious pamphlets that were written, some of whom were not at all written by clergy and established authors. There were hundreds of pamphlets published in response to Renan's book. Some of them were by cobblers or sort of printers or whoever else in the provinces. But the main new set of sources that I tried to use was letters, particularly letters that were written to Renan in the aftermath of the publication of the book, fan mail and hate mail, if you like. And there are some 300 to 400, or someone else said, you know, I was basically kind of looking at the internet trolls of the 1860s. And when some of them really are the internet trolls of the 1860s, and in fact, less polite, I think. And there are somewhere in the region of 300 to 400 letters that were written to Renan, wow. which stored at the Musée de la Vie Romantique, in the north of Paris, which is a great museum as well that everybody should visit. I think somewhere in the region of 80 or 90 of these letters, or 80, 90, sorry, 80, there's about 400 letters from the public, if you like, and 80 or 90 letters from priests as well, which is a subject of a vein of particular interest, of course. And so I wanted to try and use these letters, knowing that I could never simplistically answer, you know, did the book change the way people think, in a very straightforward way, but I wanted to see what we could do with these letters.
And in terms of what you found out about the types of different readers, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, a cobbler wrote a pamphlet, but in terms of the letters and who who was writing to him. Can you tell us a little bit more about who these people were? You know, were you exploring the responses of Catholics, Protestants, and Jews in France? Were there sort of clear political differences between the people responding to the book, men and women? You know, who are these people writing to him?
Certainly in the pamphlet and newspaper liturgy, you can break it down into Protestant, Catholic views and political lines a bit. In the manuscript literature that came in response, these letters to the author particularly, it's very difficult to draw broad conclusions, in part because sometimes the letters are so basic, they might be scrawled on one sheet of a piece of card or whatever, they don't necessarily leave their name or where they're from. Although that in itself is something which tells us something, because these are often letters which are very obviously from people who don't write letters very much.
Mm-hmm.
So we can tell they're from a particular part of the social spectrum, or they're written in slightly error-laden French, or they're written on kind of found materials, for example. So even though we don't know very much about the people who wrote those kind of letters, we know that they're almost certainly not kind of, you know, bourgeois intellectuals. So they're in themselves interesting. One conclusion we can draw with some confidence, or that I've tried to draw with some confidence, is that of the letters of which we can determine the gender, I think, I can't remember the exact figure, but something like a third are from women.
Hmm.
Which is interesting, because if in my entire analysis of the print and pamphlet literature, you very rarely hear a woman's voice.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the intellectual correspondence, you get people like Jules Sand or someone like that. But this is a kind of rare opportunity to get the voices of some women, at least. So a broad social spectrum, definitely.
So in the introduction to the book, Rob, you refer to this sort of history of the book and publishing and some of these other kinds of things. And I just wondered if you could say a few words about how you see your own book as a contribution to those conversations and debates about the history of the book in 19th and early 20th century France. You know, what does it tell us about reading and writing and publishing specifically, do you think?
Yeah, well, I don't think I'm making any kind of great kind of Copernican revolution in that world, which is a really interesting and vibrant field, it must be
mm-hmm.
said. I think the shift that my book hopefully helps to make is to looking at reading in a broader sense than fiction, which has naturally been the predominant focus of a lot of the history mm-hmm. of readership and a lot of the history of, or to some extent, the history of the book in the 19th century, in the sense that when readers respond to authors, with a few famous exceptions, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, for example, they're often responding to novelists. Novelists, poets often write the most popular works. And so hopefully this is a way of looking at reader response to a different sort of literature, using some of the tools that historians of reading in the 19th century have used. And I don't want to claim that I'm the first to look at non-fictive literature in that sense, but
mm-hmm.
there are scholars like Judith Lyon-Quin, who did an excellent study of the correspondence of Balzac and Eugène Sue, for example, whose work really inspired what I'm doing here. And what's interesting are both the similarities and the differences. So unlike the correspondence of novelists, at least the ones that Lyon-Quin looks at, not so many of Renan's correspondents write to him with their manuscripts for a play or you know, their manuscripts for a novel or whatever, asking him to try and give them some kind of patronage. By the same token, they are quite similar in the way that they sort of suggest their own ideas and suggest corrections to Renan. So one thing you see is people writing, when Sue was publishing Les Mystères de Paris, readers would write in kind of correcting things that he said about Paris, or kind of giving their own examples from their own lives to kind of suggest how he might write his next installments differently. Similarly, people write to Renan saying, you know, I think you've got this bit of the life of Jesus wrong. I've done my own reading, or I've been thinking about Jesus for my whole life and I've come to these conclusions. And they do kind of suggest corrections and alterations. So in some ways, what's interesting is actually the compatibility of this kind of reader correspondence with the kind of reader correspondence of novelists that other people have examined.
I want to come back to sort of an issue that we've touched on a little bit here and there already, which is the interaction between religion and politics in this period in France, and to ask you how you see the book, the analysis here of author, text, and reception sort of together, illuminating our understanding of the interaction of religion and politics in this period.
Yeah, sure. Well, for that, I think the relevant frame is the kind of the longer history of the reception. So right through from the 1860s to the 1900s. And one of the ways that Fanon's book has predominantly been written about is as a kind of inevitable installment in a particular conflict between church and state, between a kind of positivist intelligentsia and a kind of Catholic elite, or between what's sometimes called the culture wars of the late 19th century, and that's often one of the frames that Renan's book has been put into. Mm-hmm. What I want to suggest is that when we look at the text and its reception and to some extent its authorship, it's actually what it illustrates is more often the kind of shifting sands of the interaction between politics and religion in this period. So in 1863, at the point that this book is published, one of the big causes in religious politics, or in French politics, in fact, is about A, the influence of the church over the government, and B, freedom of expression, freedom of thought, under the Second Empire, which is to some extent a repressive political regime. And so in that context, I would argue, Vichy's had a particular kind of totemic power as this challenge to a religious establishment, which was also a kind of icon of free expression. And what's interesting when you look very closely at the reception is that many of those people, liberals, republicans, free thinkers, who you would expect to be the kind of typical favorable audience for a book which seems to be an assault on the Catholic Church, were not really that impressed. They thought the book was a little bit dilettantish. They thought it was a little bit romantic. Or they thought it was too much. You know, nobody was really happy with it on that side of the political spectrum when it came out, which is a somewhat surprising conclusion. And yet, once the Catholic opposition kicks in, once you have people like the Cardinal Bonchos making speeches saying that the book should be banned in the Senate, suddenly you get this big liberal reaction of writers, journalists coming to the defense of Renan. Similarly, when Renan loses his job at the Collège de France, you have a big groundswell of people coming to his defense. And so the book becomes iconic, but it isn't immediately iconic in that 1860s context. And there the debate is about freedom of thought, freedom of conscience. And then, just to pursue, if I may, this kind of longer history a bit, then I would say in the 1870s and 80s, once you get the establishment of a republic in France, and in the 1880s and 90s, an increasingly secular and increasingly positivistic elite ruling that republic, Renan's Life of Jesus actually sort of falls out of favor, in part because Renan was not the most dedicated republican or even particularly democratic, and in part, I think, because that kind of slightly hybrid romantic mood that the book had no longer seemed to be that kind of cutting edge avant-garde. It didn't seem to be the kind of, leading line of secular criticism in that period. So you have people like Emile Zola, a dedicated republican and to some extent opponent of the Catholic Church, saying we need to leave Renan behind. You know, what he was doing was just kind of this floral bouquet of pseudo-religious writing that made women faint. You know, that's what Zola says basically, almost explicitly in those terms, that he was basically, he was writing for women. And what we need is something more kind of muscular and aggressively scientific. So actually, Renan kind of falls out of favor for a bit. And then when it gets to after Renan's death in 1892 and towards the separation of church and state, which happens in France in 1905, Life of Jesus comes back. And that's for very specific reasons, that have to do with the particular politics and the particular symbolic position of Brittany within the contest over the relationship between church and state at the beginning of the 20th century, and the way in which unveiling a statue to Renan becomes a kind of lightning rod for many of the debates in French culture in that period, 1903-1904. So I guess, you know, what I'm saying is that the history of the relationship between politics and religion in relation to the reading of Renan's book is a history of change and of reading and rereading, and the book being read in different contexts in different ways.
We've already touched on the idea that gender, you know, may have played a role in the authorship of the Vie de Jésus and in the text itself. And we've mentioned that, you know, some of the people who wrote to Renan about the book were women. Could you say a little bit more, Rob, about what other ways, or more about the ways we've already touched on that gender figures in the book, your book?
Well, I mean, I think what I've tried to do, and people will judge whether I've been successful or not, is that the whole analysis is gendered, because I think that the whole debate was deeply gendered. And one of the most prominent ways that happened that we haven't mentioned yet is to do with this idea of Renan's book as novelistic. And that ties again into the history of the book and history of reading in this period. So in the middle of the 19th century, with the expansion of literacy, you had this idea of, on the one hand, you had the idea of new readers, that is, people like women, the working classes, provincial readers, the idea of people who were kind of uninitiated in reading. And authorities, both religious and non-religious, were very concerned about this group of people. Were they ready to read? Could they be trusted to read? Could you leave them with a text like Life of Jesus and trust them to interpret it sensibly and properly? And on the other hand, you have this particularly Catholic concern with the idea of the mauvais livre, the bad book, the kind of the dangerous book. And the mauvais livre is usually imagined as being a kind of scandalous novel. You know, you could think of something like Madame Bovary or whatever, you know, the idea of something that might corrupt your morals. But it's also could be an intellectual book. It could be Voltaire or whatever. And so Renan's book, that fear about the mauvais livre is profoundly gendered. It's about particularly a concern about what women are reading. And that's how it dovetails with this idea of the fear about new readers. So there's this deep concern that novels appeal particularly to women, and novels can be particularly dangerous and encode particularly dangerous messages, and women will be particularly susceptible to them because they're in novels. Now, when Renan releases his book, which is in some ways deliberately novelistic or novelesque, Catholic authorities immediately perceive this, and they recognize that this is a book which is written just like those terrible novels that we've been trying to stop women reading. And in fact, the message it encodes is even more dangerous than something about, you know, adultery or whatever, because it's actually an attack on the very foundation of society, which is religion. And so you can see particularly in the Catholic pamphlet literature and in what priests say in the period, that they are explicitly concerned with the fear that women will read this book and will be particularly susceptible to Renan's message.
That's really fascinating. Another thing you talk about in the book, Rob, is this idea that it tells us something about ideas about race in 19th century France. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Well, Renan's analysis of race has been probably, along with What is a Nation, has been the area of his career which has attracted the most attention in the late 20th century, particularly because it was treated in Orientalism, and it has been treated in a lot of other very important books on the history of racial thought. Svetan Todorov, Maurice Hollander, and Edward Said. So Renan, it's well known that Renan's views on race are very complex, and also very central to his analysis. And so I say in the early part of the book that one of the problems on an intellectual level and on a personal level that Renan was trying to resolve in the early part of his life was, how was it that Jesus could be both a Jew and a Christian? You know, that's not a new problem, right? But for Renan, that's particularly problematic because in his philological work in the 1850s, he developed this increasingly rigid separation of Semitic languages from Indo-European languages. And because for Renan, language structured the way you thought and language structured the type of culture you developed, that meant that there was a certain kind of incommensurability between what he would think of as a Semitic culture and what he would think of as a European culture. And so the big problem for him is that Christianity is the European religion par excellence in his view, and yet comes from the Semitic mind, which in his view is very limited. For example, he thinks that certain rigid features of Semitic languages like Hebrew somehow structure the thought processes of the people who speak those languages in order to make them less poetic, less nature loving, less capable of kind of complex rational thought in some way. I mean, the statements on the determinant role of language are very varied. At some points, he seems to be suggesting that, you know, it kind of pretty much determines absolutely everything that you think. And at other points, he's completely blasé about it and says, oh, it doesn't really matter. But there's certainly some strong idea in this early part of his career that language is determinant of culture and thought. Maurice Hollander has said that basically he kind of creates this kind of escape chute for Jesus, where Jesus can be European despite being a Jew, in order to make that work. And so the way that he does this is by setting up this incredibly stark contrast between Galilee, which for Renan is the kind of northern, fertile, green, and basically the subtext is European part of the region, and Jerusalem, Judea, is the kind of barren, dry, and the subtext is, you know, Eastern Jewish part of the region. And Jesus comes from one and not the other. And of course, it's no coincidence that when Jesus goes to Jerusalem, that's where he ends up getting into trouble. So Renan, in a sense, uses geography to kind of bypass the pickle that he gets himself in over race. And one of the things I talk about in the book is where does he get that from? And he draws quite a lot, I think, on 19th century geographical thinking, because much as racial scientists wanted to say everything was about race, geographers in the 19th century had often, particularly in the case of someone like Karl Ritter, a German geographer who Renan read a lot, want to say that geography determines everything. And so Renan can sort of use one to break open the other and turn Jesus into this kind of pseudo-European, pseudo-Semitic creature who will some way kind of bypass that problem.
You make the point, I think it might be in the introduction, Rob, where you talk about the worthwhile research that there is to be done and the international reception of Renan's text, and some of that has already been done in some of the existing scholarship, but that this is a national, that your own book is a national narrative of the work as a French text and within the French context and the debates in which it appeared. So I guess I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about how the book was received outside of France, but also a little more about the France that you're dealing with here. A lot of the book is focused on Paris, but you talk about the regions and, well, where Renan is from, certainly, and, you know, in terms of the readers responding to the text, other parts of the country are represented. So could you say a little bit more about those issues?
Yeah, sure. Yes, there's definitely a really interesting book or something to be written on the international reception of Renan that would tie together the fact that this was a book that was widely read in Latin America, Germany, Britain, France, the US, Canada, just to name a few examples, you know. And I'm sure when you trace those debates, you'll find it fitting into those contexts in slightly different ways. You know, I've looked a little bit at its reception in somewhere like Germany, where what Renan is saying about the Bible and about the life of Jesus was not new, was not original. That Germans had these big debates over the life of Jesus in intellectual circles, at least already in the 1830s, and indeed to some extent, at the end of the Enlightenment, someone like Lessing published these fragments from a German philosopher called Reimarus, which foreshadowed many of those ideas that you see in texts like Renan. So when Renan arrives in Germany, the intellectual elite at least sees it as very French. They say, you know, this is exactly what you'd expect. It's dilettantish. It's kind of florid. It's kind of, you know, impressionistic. It's everything we associate with the problems of France. And that's how the German kind of theological elite receives it. Whether it was received differently by the German public, who had access to it in German very, very rapidly, is a question which remains to be answered. And I think would be very interesting to investigate, because they might well not have been so familiar with the higher criticism of the Bible, even if they were arguably more familiar with the Bible itself than the French audience would have been. In England, by contrast, I think it became relatively popular, and part of its appeal, I think, was similar to that in France. The reason I say that my analysis is of it as a French book is because I think that most of the people that I'm looking at view Renan as a French problem. You know, they're French and they see him as posing problems about their own society. Mm. And that ranges from some of those, if you like, ordinary people who write to him, who kind of, the way that they talk about his book is incorporating it into a narrative of what they see as the threats to faith, or alternatively, the threats to free thought in France in that particular period. So they very much see it as a French text. Or if you look at the kind of way it gets brought into those politics, you know, the fact it's only in France in 1903 that you can have a riot over a statue of Renan, right? I mean, he was a global figure by that point, but it's only really in that immediate context of Brittany in the 1900s that you could have that happen, I believe. So that's what I mean when I say that it's a French, I treat it as a French problem. And yeah, I've tried to make it not just about Paris, which is, I think, what all French historians really want to do. Mm. Obviously, we're limited to some extent by the documentation, but one of the great things about the fact that Renan was so widely disseminated is that you can trace him through the provincial press, and you can find stories about, for example, the Bishop of Marseille ordering that the church bells are rung out every afternoon in penance for the assassination attempt on our Savior. And you can get stories of people getting off the train in the region and being, you know, asked by the person, the porter carrying their luggage, what are they saying about Monsieur Renan's book back in Paris? And you can have these kind of different provincial contexts as well, where, and the Breton one is really the most central in my book. And I have to say, it's not, you know, it's not as fully and authentically a pan-French book as I would have liked to have written, but I have hopefully tried at least a little bit to make it a non-Parisian book.
Mm-hmm. You explore towards the end of the book, Rob, the legacies of the text into the early 20th century, and I guess I want to ask you to say a little bit more about legacies, and also whether or not you see the book as having anything to do with maybe more current, you know, conversations that, for obvious reasons, are very urgent around secularism, you know, laïcité, Frenchness, national identity, those kinds of things.
Well, I'll start with the legacy. So the legacy, as I say, Renan becomes the centre of a controversy again in the run-up to the separation of church and state. And then, although I haven't traced things, the book ends there. So the book really ends in 1903, 1904, mm-hmm. with the erection of, on the one hand, a statue to Renan in his hometown of Tréguier, and on the other hand, a Calvary that the Catholic Church erects in protest at a statue being erected to Renan. You have so these kind of two lineups, you know, monument and counter monument. And, you know, the Renan monument faces onto the cathedral. It's very transparent what the Republicans are trying to do here. And people march through the street saying, you know, vive la libre pensée. My favorite thing that happens, and I can't remember if there's a picture of it in the book or not, is the Republicans climb up the church tower and they hang a banner saying, I think, Vive la Libre Pensée, long live free thought. And then a few hours later, Catholics go one step higher up the cathedral tower and hang a kind of raggedy sign that says, Vive le Christ, right? Long live Christ. Mm. So they kind of like monument, counter monument, banner, counter banner. You get this very kind of, it's by that point, French politics is very polarized, and Renan's book gets sucked into that polarization. After that, I think the book's controversy and prominence really decline across the 20th century, somewhat in tandem with Renan's own reputation and prominence as a thinker. And so by today, I mean, I can't speak for contemporary French people, but it's not the most widely read book, it has to be said. In terms of contemporary resonances, it was really interesting. I gave a paper on it to my departmental seminar about 2 weeks after the Charlie Hebdo massacre, and people were very struck by the images of the luminaries of the Republic lining up on the streets behind this book, which was iconoclastic, right? And there was some kind of loose parallel you could draw to what happened when, you know, the leaders of the Republic came out on the streets in January, to say Je suis Charlie, this idea that somehow the state was identifying with this icon of controversy. Although, of course, the contexts are incredibly different. And I don't really want to draw particularly any grand lesson for contemporary French secularism from this book, except to say that I think what the book does show, and it's not the only book to show this by any means, is that that whole idea of laïcité and that whole idea of that kind of clean and natural idea of laïcité, at least, the idea that there's a kind of straightforward sense in which we know what that means is wrong. You know, that there's always been this kind of contestation, negotiation, dialogue, this kind of messy compromise between church and state. And even the things that you might take as an icon of secularism, which is how Life of Jesus was taken on the streets of Brittany in 1903, is itself a very confused and confusing book, which seems on the one hand to endorse and eulogize Catholicism and on the other hand to undermine and attack it. And I think that messiness of the legacy of Renan's book is indicative of the kind of messiness of the history of laïcité that the historians like Jean Beauberot have drawn brilliant attention to. And so I think the only real lesson we can take for today's politics is life is messy. Laïcité is messy. Religion is messy. And the history of the legacy of Renan's book is a fine example of quite how messy that is. So we should be careful about jumping to conclusions or thinking that we know what these different concepts mean, mm-hmm. or that certainly that they have straightforward and inevitable histories.
So there's just one last question I want to ask you, Rob, which is, what are you working on now?
Two things at the moment. The one thing I'm looking at is the kind of history, a kind of French intellectual history project, which is about the ways all of the different historians at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century who interpreted the revolution, the French Revolution, as a religious event. Mm. Famously, Tocqueville said that the French Revolution was a political revolution which proceeded in the manner of a religious revolution. I don't think people who have really fully evaluated the extent to which many 19th century French historians thought that the French Revolution was something akin to the Reformation. And so I'm kind of tracing that that line of analysis. The other project, which is not French at all, draws more on the Jesus side of things, and that is sort of provisionally entitled Jesus Christ Superstar. And it's a history of the Oberammergau Passion Play, which is this passion play in Bavaria in Germany, which first started in the 1630s and continues to the present day every 10 years, but really exploded to international popularity at around the same time as Renan was writing in the late 19th century. And so I'm interested in how a very different story about the life and death of Jesus could become an international spectacle and controversy in the same period. But hopefully, once that's done, if it's ever done, I can get back to France completely. But for the meantime, my mind is very much in Germany for some reason. I can't really fully figure it out.
Well, those both sound like really interesting projects. And if one of them emerges in new book form at some point, you'll come back and talk to me about it. Rob, I just want to thank you so much for writing the book and for taking the time to speak with me about it.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Roxanne.